Good morning, good people. This week on The Local Take, I am welcoming back Dr. Fahamu Pico, world-renowned artist whose work focuses on African-American masculine identity. His work has been exhibited around the world and has been in various television shows, including Black-ish and Empire. His current exhibit at the Michael C. Carlos Museum at Emory University is considered the first exhibition that is also a PhD dissertation. Dr. Fahamu Pico, welcome back to The Local Take.
It's always a pleasure to be here with you, Kipling. Thank you for having me.
I love to have you, love talking to you about your work. And I'd like to start with just a little bit of your history. Can you tell us how you actually became a fine artist? And then that designation, fine artist, could you share exactly what that means as opposed to, say, a graphic artist, which I know you also were at one time?
Sure. So my background in art has been one I think that a lot of people might be able to identify with. You know, when my first love of art began as a child, I just loved to draw. And so that's all I did. And I knew from an early age that I wanted to be an artist, but I didn't know exactly what that meant or how one became an artist. And I wasn't even familiar with the designation of fine artist until I got to college. So I came into college as an animation major, but, you know, I was very quickly introduced to the fine arts, which is, you know, painting, sculpture, you know, the more classical forms of art and presentation. And actually, it was by a really good friend of mine who was a fellow college student with me at the Atlanta College of Art, who kind of, you know, poked me in the side like, yeah, those cartoons you're drawing are cute and everything, but come with me to this museum, you know. And that was my first time at 18 years old, you know, going to a museum. And it was actually the High Museum. It was the first museum I ever went to. And, you know, so after, you know, spending time in the Atlanta College of Art and, you know, learning about, you know, art history and, you know, even studying at Spelman with Dr. Arturo Lindsay, learning more about, you know, the practice of fine art, you know, I changed my major from animation to painting, and I never looked back. But to the second half of your question, the distinction really is around, you know, art as a form of expression. And when we talk about things like graphic design, we're talking more about commercial art. So it's less about your own ideas and more about, you know, trying to serve the need of a client and communicate a specific idea. But with the fine arts, you know, it's really more about expression of our human experience.
And there has been graphic art that has risen to the level of fine art
Almost and become certainly collectible. Yeah.
And there's been, you know, fiction that becomes literature. Mm-hmm. So it's just those distinctions, I think, in our community that a lot of times we're not aware of.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, it's at the end of the day, it's all art, you know, and, you know, and graphic design, like fine art, like, you know, other kinds of commercial arts are just expressions of various mediums, you know. You know, people often talk about, you know, the art form of music, and we often think of like singers as, you know, music, but rap is also music, you know, it's also literature, you know, and so there's these different ways of expression that I think come through with the arts. And for us as a community, I think it's more important that we just allow ourselves to be open to what art can be as opposed to trying to dictate what art should be.
I love that. What art can be instead of what it should be. Now, you've often shared that your career started out due to cartoons as a little boy, you know, loving to draw and Charles Schulz being an animator. How have your ideas about art changed from that young boy who drew all the time and who, you know, aspired to be an animator to the Dr. Fahamu Pico of today? How did that change?
I don't know if it is so much of a change as much as it is evolution. You know, again, I was very much moved by animation and cartoons, but that's because, you know, at the age of nine, when I first learned about cartoon animating as a career, I made the decision to become a cartoon animator because it seemed like a viable pathway to being able to be an artist and make money, you know, because so many people would always say stuff like, you're going to be a starving artist and you're not going to make any money till you die. And, you know, I didn't want to be in that, you know, kind of a situation. And so, you know, as much as I wanted to be an artist, I was trying to figure out how do you, you know, have a career as an artist and make money. And animation became like, you know, a concrete way to do that. And so I aspired to be an animator because it would allow me to make art and make money. But as I said, when I got to college and I was introduced to the fine arts, I realized that there are all kinds of ways to make money as an artist and all kinds of ways to survive and have a career as an artist. And you didn't just have to go, you know, a commercial route with it. But in terms of my ideas, I think, you know, one of the things that really kind of shaped my voice as an artist was really around my junior year in college. I was listening to Goody Mob's first album, Soul Food. And there's a song on there called Guess Who, where all of the guys on the song talk about the impact of their mother's love, you know. And that song was really, it really gripped me because, you know, I lost my own mom when I was like 4 years old. And I could identify with everything that they were saying about, you know, how their mother's love covered them, you know. And I began making art about my own mom and about the night that she died when I was four. And that ultimately became my senior exhibition in undergrad. And as I watched people interact with that work, you know, when it was finally installed in the gallery, it was then that I really understood the power of art. And, you know, people were coming up to me and they were sharing these really like intimate and personal experiences that they had and how my work had moved them to a different kind of place or gave them some hope or gave them some healing. And I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. You know, I want to make art that's not just pretty pictures, but that will make this world a better place. You know, I want to make art that will help us deal with our traumas. I want to make art that will help us feel better about ourselves, that can change people's lives, you know. And that ultimately, you know, became the impetus for the type of work that I do. It's like, you know, I always say that being an artist is like having a mutant ability or like a superpower or something like that. And with that power comes great responsibility. And so for me, I think of my art as this gift that I've been given from the creator and a way for me to communicate and to open up, you know, back to the world in a really impactful way.
Art as healing, that is such a strong sentiment, but I think when we do engage and interact with art, we can be healed, and that's from theater mm-hmm. to music.
Exactly.
And while it might sound cliche, it's actually the truth.
Yeah. And I think, you know, some of the most impactful art experiences that we have had, regardless of the medium, regardless of the form, have been those things that move us emotionally, that grip us emotionally, that allow us to see the world in a way that we hadn't seen it before, allow us to feel things that we hadn't felt before, allow us to have conversations that we never had before. And so, you know, that's what I aspire to do through my work.
Now, the other thing that you mentioned is, you know, people saying that you would be a starving artist, that, you know, artists don't make money or they don't get famous until they're dead. And that seems to be an adage that still lives on. I know, you know, people with children who draw mm-hmm. and they're trying to push them into something else. How can we, you know, educate our community about the art as career? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we live in this time where content, you know, there are people producing content on all kinds of platforms with all kinds of followers. But we still have this thing about, you know, people who create content, people who create mm-hmm. not being able to make money.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, one of the early experiences that I had as I began to travel around with my work, I was actually at Grambling State, and I was doing a residency there, and I was talking to, you know, the chair of the art program, and they were talking about the challenges that they had of keeping the program running because they couldn't get the funding that they needed to really support the program. And a part of the reason that they couldn't get the funding is because they didn't have the students to major in the program. And the reason that they weren't getting the majors is all these really talented students, you know, who really had an interest and a passion and a desire to go into the arts, had parents who were telling them, I'm not paying for your school if you don't major in something that you can get a job in, right? And, you know, that's sad that continues to, you know, be something that impacts our community, because ultimately we don't know how many Stevie Wonders that we've lost. We don't know how many Jacob Lawrences that we've lost to a job. And a job never made anybody happy. You know what I'm saying?
Like, and it definitely won't make you rich.
Right, exactly. And, you know, at the end of the day, like, a job is something that can be taken away from you. But your ability, your creative ability, your ability to express and interpret and, you know, shape the world, no one can ever take that away from you. And I think it's important as a community that we engage the arts more. And that's a kind of a double-edged sword kind of a statement, because I think we also have to understand that there are levels and ways of engagement that we have as a community around the arts that is not necessarily considered in the broader society as an arts engagement, right? But it is very specific to our community and to the way that we experience the world. And I think that there needs to be, you know, proper reverence given to that. But I also think that we have to find ways to, you know, more actively engage in the arts and not just look at it as a hobby, right? Because it is ultimately, art is ultimately a reflection of human experience. You know, one of my favorite quotes is, in the future, historians will tell what happened, but artists will tell how it felt, you know? And what we say, what we do as artists, what we create is important because it is a record of our humanity in this world. And again, there's everybody who can, you know, whip a paintbrush or whip a pencil may not be hanging in a museum one day. And that's fine. But they may be the next museum director. They may be the next curator. They may be the next art dealer or collector, you know, even if they get a job as a lawyer, you know, if it's a young person who has a talent for drawing all through high school and they go to college and they, you know, decide to, you know, minor in art and major in law. Like, they may become the next big lawyer with a huge art collection, but we have to see the appreciation and understanding of the impact of the arts and why it's necessary. Otherwise, you know, we lose our own selves in that.
And we lose our own humanity. Yes. If we don't make a record of it, who will? Exactly. If our artists don't,
exactly,
who will? Now, your exhibit that is going on right now at the Michael C. Carlos Museum at Emory is Do or Die. This is your PhD dissertation. Can you share how this work differs from your work before or your previous work?
It's actually in conversation with work that I've been doing before. As you mentioned before, my work addresses representations of Black male masculinity and in that, in all its myriad forms, you know. So I'm not trying to paint pretty pictures or positive pictures of Black masculinity. I'm just telling stories of Black masculinity, as whole and complicated and complex as that may be. And Do or Die was actually inspired by an invitation from Mark Sloan, who's the director of the Halsey Institute of Contemporary Art at the College of Charleston. I had met Mark in maybe 2013. And we talked about the possibility of me doing a show at the Halsey, to quote him, when the time was right. So fast forward a couple years down the line, it's now 2015, and we've seen at this point anywhere from a dozen to 18, 20, you know, assassinations of young Black men and women at the hands of police officers. Unarmed, you know, young Black men and women. One spring day I get home from work and I open an envelope that's in my mailbox and, you know, I pull it out. It's a copy of the Post Courier, which is the local newspaper in Charleston. And on the front page is the story about Walter Scott, the gentleman who was shot in the back by a North Charleston police officer. And attached to the newspaper was a sticky note that said, "It's time." And this was Mark's invitation for me to, you know, create a body of work, knowing that I was already engaging in these conversations around Black masculinity and notions of resistance and all these kinds of things. He invited me to create a body of work in conversation with these killings. my initial reaction was to try to create some type of memorial, but that felt too much like reaffirming this idea that we could be destroyed, you know, at the hands of white supremacy. And I wanted to do something that, again, would resist that idea. And so Do or Die ultimately became this conversation around the balance between life and death, but ultimately the fact that our bodies, our spirits, you know, who we are as a people extends far beyond any threat of death that can be imposed on us. And this was really coming out of an observation of mine that, you know, our experiences with death and, you know, in Western society is perverted. You know, people die every day. Like, death is a part of life. It's a natural part of life. But for Black people, we experience death in a really traumatic and uneasy way. It's not something where you say when you get to the end of your life, you've lived this long life, now you can die in peace. Like, our death is anything but peaceful. And this threat of death, this threat of violence has been something that has been wielded against us to keep us in line, to keep us silent, to keep us from bucking back against the system that has its foot on our neck. This threat of death has been used to hold us back. And I wanted to create a body of work that would allow us to think about our lives and our legacy and our ancestry, who we are as a people, over and above this threat of death. So that ultimately the question is, what kind of life could you live if you weren't afraid to die?
Fahamu, that is wonderful. And I'm going to share again that this exhibit is called Do or Die, and is at the Michael C. Carlos Museum at Emory University through the end of April. And I definitely want to thank you for always coming to share information with us about your art and your life and this ongoing conversation about Black masculinity in the 21st century of the United States.
Well, thank you.
I want to thank you so much for that. So you mentioned previously that the exhibit Do or Die is about what life would look like if we didn't live in a society or a community where it's so easy for death to find us. Mm-hmm. You know, you're in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. You've got a cell phone in your hand. You don't say yes, sir, or no, sir, in the way that someone expects you to say it. And if you buck at any wrong time, you know, someone is, police officers mm-hmm. are putting their hands on right. a holster. Mm-hmm. What do you think would be our life? What would our culture be like if we didn't live in, you know, 21st century USA, where it's still difficult because of the color of your skin to live free?
Well, you know, I don't know what that would look like, right? But and as a point of clarification, I should also add that when I refer to death, I'm not talking about like physically dying, but there's a concept of what's called social death as well, you know, which is the marginalization of people of color, which is the oppression of people of color, which is, you know, blocking access to loans and other economic development strategies, you know, like that's a kind of death as well, right? And I think that, you know, there's no telling who or what we could be if we didn't have these obstacles, if we didn't have these obstructions, you know, blocking us from living full lives. And again, this is what art allows us to do. It allows us to imagine these spaces, and allowing us to imagine these spaces, then we ultimately can create these spaces, because you can't create anything until you can see it, until you can imagine it. And so if your life is surrounded by, if you're shrouded, constantly shrouded with these images of death and dying and destruction and mayhem and trauma, you can't see past that. You can't imagine past that. You can't think past that. And so what I hope to do through my art is to show us something else, to show us that there is other ways for us to see, other ways for us to think, other ways for us to be. And then in giving permission for people to see and be those things, then we can create new ways of living.
It's creating a new story.
Yeah.
Now, you also mentioned the perverted vision, the Western civilization's perverted kind of vision of death. And I grew up in Louisiana, and we called on the ancestors mm-hmm. all the time, because in my growing up, it was described to me that these spirits are always right. there and accessible to you. And for me, depending on what it is I need, you know, I might call on this mm-hmm. aunt, or I yep. might call on this grandmother exactly. or grandfather. So is that what you're saying when you're talking about death being a little bit perverted in exactly. our civilization?
Yeah. So death is, again, it's the death has been used as this threat, right? So it's not difficult to imagine, but when Europeans and colonizers brought enslaved Africans to this country, they would bring them off of the ships. They would line them up. They would find the biggest guy in the group, and they would maim him, beat him, kill him even, you know, for other people to see. If they do that to him, we'll do it to you too, you know? And so that's kind of like this threat, like this, you know, imposition of violence that is destined for you if you don't fall in line, right? And because we were denied access to our spiritual selves and to our culture and history and memory, we lost touch with who we are and who we were. And the Yoruba religion is really powerful in that sense, because it does give us a glimpse of who we were and who we continue to be. You know, I didn't grow up in the same kind of environment as you. You know, I grew up more traditional Christian and stuff like that, and was told not to ask any questions. But when I was first introduced to Yoruba or Ifa, one of the first things I had learned about was the veneration of ancestors and the importance of ancestors as a connection to not only my own direct lineage, but to my history and to my memory of who I am and who I will ultimately become, one of the ancestors. And I'd like us to return to that kind of understanding, because it does empower us in a way to understand that death is not the end. You can't destroy me. You know, you might take my body, but you can never take my spirit. You can never take my soul. And guess what? Because in Yoruba, we believe we can come back again, you know? And I think that also changes the way that we not only think about ourselves, but the way that we move in the world too. Because if you know that you will inherit this earth again, you take better care of it, right? Because you got to come back here. You know what I'm saying? So there's all of these little parts and pieces of it that are much more sustainable, you know, than the ways that we've been taught about who we are.
Now, you brought up Yoruba, and that has come up in quite a few of the reviews about Do or Die. And there was just an article in the Baltimore Sun, I believe it is, a few weeks ago about African-Americans turning to voodoo religions. And I was so offended, because it's like, you know, these religions have been around right. for centuries. And
long before Western Abrahamic religions. Yeah.
And Abrahamic religions follows the same right. storylines. Mm-hmm. I think most people do know that, but some people aren't aware that these stories of a savior, mm-hmm. 12 disciples, mm-hmm. virgin birth, these right. are stories around almost every yep. religion that has existed in mankind, mm-hmm. including those ancient mm-hmm. African ones. But why do you think there's been this renaissance, again, in the 21st century with African Americans around these ancient religions? Why are we delving back kind of, or bringing them forward?
I think there are a number of reasons. Number one, our ancestors are powerful. They never, you know, they ain't going nowhere. And when, you know, it's just like, you know, if you cutting up in church or school or something like that, grandma will remind you of who you are. Do you know who you with? Do you know who your people are? You better act right. You know, and in a sense, that is what we're seeing happening, you know, more and more as more of, you know, the structures and systems in this world that have kept us down and oppressed and marginalized us start to undo themselves. We're now seeing more and more the fallacy in these things that we've been taught to believe, you know, that these things, again, they are not sustainable. And the things that are sustainable are rising back to the surface. But I think there are a number of scholars, of artists, of thinkers and creators who are engaging, you know, our African ancestral legacies and histories and memories through their work, which is making it more accessible to more and more people. You know, when Beyonce did her Lemonade thing, you know, a few years back, I can't tell you how many think pieces people wrote about the Orishas based on what was happening in Beyonce's work. You know, I've been able to see a number of popular entertainers who I didn't make connections to before, but I see that they are also engaged in African spiritual systems. You know what I'm saying? Like, every now and then you'll catch a picture of them and they got Eleke on. You know, and it's like, what's, oh, okay, snap, that makes sense. Now I start to see how the pieces come together, you know. But I think the popularity of it, the rise in the popularity of you know, even if you just start to see mentions of Beyonce Oshun, well, who's Oshun? And then you start to read and you start to, oh, this actually makes a lot of sense to me. I want to know more. That's really all it is people want to know more. And the more people know, the more people can do.
You know, you're reminding me of your mural at the MLK station. And whenever I see that picture, I always think of those stories about the flying Africans, mm-hmm. because you are flying.
Yeah. And in fact, the mural at the Ashby station is called The People Could Fly. Yeah.
I love that. And I always love when we go back to some of those stories and myths in our history. Now, you are bringing me, though, right to the next question. In a lot of the coverage of this new exhibit from you, media outlets are now referring to you as an artist and a scholar. How does that designation of scholar being added to your bio and into your continents, how will that impact your work, or will it?
It certainly impacted my work in terms of my approach, you know, to the projects that I do. And, you know, and I would say elevates it to a certain degree. I've always maintained a research practice as a part of my work. I've always done a lot of reading and kind of preparation before going into the image making process. But, you know, doing a PhD program and learning different strategies and methodologies for research has really enhanced the way that I go about doing that. I think it also changes the conversation because, you know, again, as much as I tried to be deliberate about the fact that I'm not painting just pretty pictures, like this is not just eye candy, there's really something being said here. I think that the designation now of being Dr. Peku, you know what I'm saying, like, people expect, you know, there to be a deeper level of meaning behind these images. And I think the kinds of questions changes, the level of interrogation changes, and even the way that I write about the work, you know, has changed dramatically. And so, you know, I don't, however, want the scholar thing to be a barrier, you know, because ultimately at the end of the day, like, I've decided and been intentional about using art as my means of communication of this kind of scholarship, because it is more accessible, because it's more easily legible to people. Like, you don't have to be a PhD to read a painting. You know what I'm saying? Like, there are ways that you can engage through the arts that I think are really important and really imperative and really help to change the conversation.
Now, your exhibit, Do or Die, is through April 28th at the Michael C. Carlos Museum. What do you want people to walk out of that exhibition feeling?
I don't know that I have one specific expectation, but I will share a quick anecdote if I can. There was a young woman who reached out to me recently. She and her boyfriend went to see the exhibition, and she sent me a note thanking me because she said that after they saw the exhibition, she and her boyfriend went to lunch and he unloaded all of these feelings and experiences and just, you know, traumatic experiences that he's had around, like, police and violence and just the kinds of violence that black men deal with on the daily that, you know, he'd never really felt he had an outlet to share. But the show opened up, you know, this window, you know, into him. And she was like, he just laid all this stuff out on the table. And she said, we had the most meaningful, powerful conversations. And it was all because your work gave him permission to share, you know, his experiences with me. And she was like, we've been together for years and we never had a conversation like that before. Thank you for that, you know? And so for me, it's like I said, it's not just one thing that I hope to get out of it, but I really do hope that it will allow people opportunities to engage with these experiences that we have as black people that a lot of people are unaware of. And as black people, allow us permission to think about ourselves as something other than victims, that we can be victorious despite the things that have been thrown at us, that we will survive, not that we can, we will survive.
Now, we've been talking just a little while longer, and I want to bring up, I said earlier you were a world-renowned artist, and you've got an exhibition that's coming to LA. Can you share a little bit about that exhibition and how it differs from, you know, Do or Die? And is this your first time on the West Coast? What's that look like for you?
Well, it's not my first time on the West Coast. I've done shows in a few shows in San Francisco and in Seattle, but this is my first time in LA. So I'm really excited about that. The exhibition is called Trapademia. And Trapademia is this concept that I came up with a few years ago that basically explores notions of the trap, not as we kind of talk about it now, it's like selling drugs and stuff like that, but that trapping is ultimately a methodology that's used by marginalized and oppressed people as a means of subverting the system. You know, like, it's alternative economies, it's hustling. You know, we all hustle, we all know people that hustle. You know, like the candy lady was trapping, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's an alternative, you know, economy that is, you know, created. And in those spaces, we can learn a whole new perspective about the world if we understand this trapademic environment, right? And so Trapademia kind of engages that, but it looks at it through the lens of African spirituality and African ideologies and philosophies meshed with contemporary black experiences here in the United States. And so it's just dialogue, you know, between, you know, these alternative lifestyles and ways of being and what people kind of see on the surface. So I'm kind of using trap music as a sort of roadmap. I'm using some lyrics and content from trap music to get us to think about trap in a different way.
And one question about collection, and Fahamu, I know you probably saw this, but you occasionally on your social media will offer, you know, special price, mm-hmm. until this date. And I always go out, I always put something in the cart, and then I never go back. And then like 2 days later, I'm like, did you buy it? Did you do it? And it's gone. But let's talk just a little bit about collection, because mm-hmm. you always, I mean, you, there are Fahamu Piku socks, mm-hmm. There are posters, mm-hmm. there are ways that you can collect fine art that doesn't necessarily have to be expensive.
Yeah. And I mean, there are ways I don't know any of my people who have ever had a problem putting something on layaway that you really want. You know, you can do the same thing with artists. You know, even if it's a piece that's $100 and you got 10 today, just make it known that that's what you want to do. You know, I think we often, you know, because we see in the news, oh, Basquiat painting sells for $180 million. Oh, I'll never, you know, be able to do that, you know, and so we don't even try. You know, sometimes it's just a matter of making an effort. And I think, again, like to your point before about the importance of us telling our stories, because nobody else is going to tell it correctly, collecting art is a part of telling that story. You know, you don't have to go out and buy the most expensive art to start an art collection. Collect what you like. Buy what you like. Buy what you can live with, what you love, like something that moves you. You like it, get it. Support the artists. That's another way that we make sure that our artists aren't starving.
And I always love, you say that often, talk to me. Right. If you want to get it, talk to me. We can work something out.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of having a conversation. It kind of grinds my gears a little bit, but I have so many people like, you know, one day I'm going to buy one of your paintings. But you realize if you don't start today, tomorrow is going to be even more. So that day keeps getting pushed back and back. Just tell if there's something you like today, just let me know. We can work something out.
I love it. So Fahamu Piku, Dr. Fahamu Piku, for our listeners who want to get in touch with you, who want to follow you, how can they do so? Give out your tags and social media and all that kind of good stuff.
Sure. So I'm online. My website is fahamupekuart.com. That's FAHAMUPECOUART.com. And I'm also on Instagram at Fahamu Peku.
My favorite artist to work with and to talk to. Thank you so much for coming and sharing this information with us today. Thank you so much for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.